on the front line of freedom. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our visit with 91-year-old Francis O'Brien of Modesto, California. He was on the swim team at St. Joseph's and later the football team at Dartmouth. But in between, he was on a legendary team known as the 4th Marine Division. In the span of 7 months in 1944, he would participate in 3 invasions in the Pacific. Wounded in 2 of them, he received the Bronze Star with a V for Valor for his heroics in the other. He shared some of his training adventures in the Marine Corps. Now Mr. O'Brien takes us along as he heads overseas in January of 1944.
We had no idea where we were going, but we knew we were leaving. We went to the Hawaiian Islands at first. I'll never forget being on topside of the ship, seeing a fire on Maui, because in those days they burnt the sugar cane. They set the fields on fire. And here this sugar cane field was on fire, and the sun was coming up. The heat of the fire was shimmering, the rays of the sun. And I thought, gee, this is beautiful. Why are we going to war? No, this was a beautiful thing, you know. Let's relax. Let's just enjoy. But that's not what happened. So then we finally get told where we're going. We're going to the Marshall Islands at a place called Kwajalein, which was the largest island-enclosed portion of the lagoon in the Pacific Ocean. One end of the lagoon was Kwajalein. At the other end of the island was a place called Roy and the Moor. And we were going to land on the Moor. And our lieutenant said, you know, tomorrow we're going to land on the Moor. There are about 2,500 Japanese there. We're going to land with about 2,500 men. And in 24 hours, it is either ours or we're all dead. And that was the pep talk.
That's encouraging, isn't it?
Very encouraging. So we're supposed to land by LVTs, which are landing vehicle tractor. They had problems before with Tarawa, where the landing boats got hung up on a reef. The tide had changed and whatever else had happened, and they couldn't get in. The men had to wade ashore about a couple hundred yards offshore, had to wade to get on the island.
And a lot of them didn't get on the island. They got mowed down trying to get there.
A lot didn't get there, and so now we're going to bypass that action. We're going to go in the back way into the lagoon, and we'll have aerial guys from the 25th Marines going. We were the 24th. From the 25th Marines going to set up artillery on these little islets to kind of support us as we came in the back way. Well, you're aboard the USTs, and we had to put camouflage paint on and all that business, and we did. Then we got aboard the LVTs. Now we were supposed to leave at 10 o'clock, but it takes time to get LVTs off. Then once they're lined up, then the commanders go, and you go towards the island. That way, everybody is on the island pretty much at the same time. So we got on the island, and we had a young guy from Champaign, Illinois, who was bet by some hot shot in his class that he could get in the Marine Corps, and Frank couldn't. Frank was so naive, he said, I bet him. He said, I got in the Marine Corps, and he didn't, plus the fact I didn't get the $50. And that's the kind of gullibility. I mean, and a super smart kid. I think they claim he had the highest IQ in the division. But anyway, we land. Someone said, where's Frank? I said, I don't know. He's probably behind somewhere. I said, I'll go back and check. And I went back to check. And Frank was in a hole in his helmet. He was dead. And there he was sitting there. He's the first casualty that I saw. And, you know, that leaves the mark on you that, well, you know, when someone says, sniper, be awake, be alert. There's probably somebody who in there doing something. So we went through the moor. We got down through a clearing, and I was a bazooka man and firing these rockets. I had never fired a rocket before because you don't expend the ammunition and all that. You go through the dry runs. So the officer said there was a house and a spotlight, a searchlight, and he said, see if you can hit the house. You know, see if you can. So I aimed and hit the house and blew it up. And when that happens, this is different now than being trained. Now see what you can do when you do it. That kind of gives you some enthusiasm. Now you become almost like a showboat. Boy, I can hit that house. And then he said, there was a Japanese sitting up on top of a revetment. He said, O'Brien, you hit the Japanese and I'll kiss your eyes. And I thought that was an interesting challenge. So I aimed, and what happens with the Zooka tube, it's just a pipe. As it gets hot from the propellant in the rocket, you're almost aiming at the ground because it'll take off on you. I was aiming at the ground and apparently hit the Japanese, and he's on my back, banging on my shoulder, just like he scored a touchdown. Hooray, hooray, on his back. So now we thought we were going to take over the island. So Al Prusik, the officer, and Norman Savage, just a guy like I was, the three of us take off to the revetment. And as we got there, our machine gunners opened fire on the revetment. At the same time, the Japanese in the revetment opened fire. So now we're on our back watching all these tracer bullets go by, because between each tracer, there's probably three or four regular bullets. And we watched that for about a half an hour. It was thrilling. It was neat. It was something we hadn't done before. Now they cease firing. So I got up first, and I led the bunch out, and I'm running down. And I kind of made a half turn to my left. And as I did, I felt like I got hit in the apoplexy of your body. And I kind of lost my breath. I kept running, got down into the hole, and my little finger on my left hand was just hanging off, just like a chicken wing had been broken. It wasn't bleeding, it wasn't hurting, but it looked kind of strange. Prusik, the officer, came in, and I said, I've been hit. He said, you haven't been. I said, look at that finger. Hey, damn if you haven't. So for the first time, I had seen a first aid packet open up. And all a first aid packet was a piece of Kotex about 4 or 5 inches long, with about 72 yards of cotton bandage, and miserable. You try putting that on the finger that's hanging out, and it doesn't do much. Now, I just casually put my hand up under my dungaree jacket, and man, it was a warm hole, and I thought, wow, what's that? And at that time, it's amazing. I couldn't speak. I couldn't talk. And Prusik wanted to give me some water. And I remember an old movie where Edward G. Robinson, I think it was, got raked by a machine gun. He had taken a drink of water and he was trying to plug up the holes with his fingers as the water was coming out. And I said, I don't want water. You know, let me alone. About that time, a very good friend of mine, D.B. Kellenberger, came to the top of the hole and looked down at me. We had no communication. We had no phones. We had no cell phone. We had nothing. So DB took his jacket off. I can still see him now. Took his helmet off. And we had been aboard ship for quite a while. So we were tan. We looked like we were Japanese, I suppose. And DB went running back to get some help for me. And while doing that, one of our guys, friendly fire, shot, and he later on died.
Oh.
And here was a guy who was, DB was at Pearl Harbor on December the 7th. And he was up all day. Then he got assigned to guard duty that night, and while on guard duty, fell asleep and got caught. I think he got a general court-martial. They're going to put him in the brig forever, I suppose. And then later on, they cleaned the brig out and sent DB to the 4th Marine Division. And DB's brag to fame was he was the oldest private in the Marine Corps, which he couldn't be promoted, and there he was. And yet DB was, I mean, just a delightful guy. He used to impersonate W.C. Fields. He never wore a belt on his dungarees. He used to tie it up with a shoestring. Why, I don't know. And we used to play cards aboard the ship. And we always won. I don't know how we did that, but we did. Here he was. He dies going to get help for me. You know, a guy that he had just met. So, I mean, you know, it's that kind of stuff that makes you wonder, you know, what a war is all about.
So you're 20 years old, you're hit in the chest, and your finger's hanging off, and this was your first experience in combat, period.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That's not very encouraging. Take me from there. How did you deal with that situation?
Well, you know, in reading about our division was one of the probably youngest divisions in the Marine Corps. We went through 4 major battles, which means 4 major landings. Wound up with probably, I guess, 20% were casualties. You know, you've got about 20,000 guys in the division, but a lot of them are mechanics or paper. They're cooks or some other things. They're not combat men. They're not out in the field, but out there shooting and being shot at.
That percentage was a lot different for the guys who were doing what you were doing.
I mean, and that kind of campers which way you're trying to talk.
How much pain were you in?
It's interesting. I had no pain.
Huh.
I had no pain. They sent some guys up as stretcher bearers. And these were usually band men or cooks or something. And they came up. They didn't have a stretcher, so we had to improvise a stretcher. Well, then they couldn't lift me.
You were one of the bigger guys, huh?
So they couldn't lift me, so they dragged me through all these holes over to the beach. And again, honestly, nothing hurt.
Were you scared?
And I wasn't bleeding, and I was still conscious. I knew what was going on. And we got down to the evacuation center. I remember the guy saying, "Where's the hospital ship?" Well, there were about 9 transports out there. It's out there. We went out, we'd bump into a ship, and it's just the hospital ship. Says, "No, try T-boats over." And we kept going. Finally, we got to a hospital ship. They lowered this thing down and hooked up my stretcher and picked me up and put me aboard the ship. And the first thing they did was take your valuables. And I think I had a New Testament and something else in the pocket. And they put that on my chest. Well, then they took all my clothes off and put my valuables on my chest. Took me to the mess room where the cooks had been and all that business and laid me on the table. And then they started asking, "How did it happen?" "How do I know how it happened? Some guy shot me." "Well, where did it go?" I said, "I have no idea." So they rolled me over and finally found there was a hole about the size of a little finger just above my hip. That was the entry.
And then it
came out by my navel. Uh-huh. I left about a 4x4 hole.
Oof.
And there it was. And
how many vital organs did that thing
hit?
Yeah,
I mean, it didn't hit anything. It didn't hit a thing.
Isn't that miraculous?
It is a miracle. Yeah, I mean, and I remember one of the doctors who had been at Mayo Clinic, he said, "O'Brien, you're in such good shape. The bullet took the course of least resistance. I'd give me a break." You know?
How long did it take you to recover before you went back?
I went back in the end of May, and the wounds happened on the 2nd or 3rd of February.
So that's 3 months. Long,
but I was ambulatory.
Yeah.
I was walking.
During that time, were you ever scared or concerned that you weren't going to make it? Or that
I wasn't scared of that, but you know where proud flesh is?
Uh-huh.
Okay, well, in the wound, right from the center of it, proud flesh started developing. And I was puffing up. He had the illusions. Maybe the shell is still in there, and it hasn't gone off yet.
That would get your attention, sure.
Yeah, and I, you know, and I kept watching this thing. And finally, a doctor came in. He was the guy from Mayo Clinic. Just grabbed the pair of clippers and clipped off the proud flesh, and that was it. And never, it didn't hurt. And of course, it disappeared. It didn't come back.
What about your finger?
And the finger was, I guess I finally, you know, I could move it. And, of course, that gives you something else you can do. You can move the finger. And I don't have any stitches they had in there. But I remember when they cut it off, my first question was, "This won't put me out of the Marine Corps, will it?" The doctors assured me it wouldn't.
Well, you say that pretty matter of fact, but that's a big deal for someone really to come to grips with the fact that, hey, I had 10 and now I've got 9.
Well, I mean, when I was teaching, I used to sometimes do this. And the kids wouldn't know what was going on, or I do this, and they wouldn't know what was going on.
Make your invisible finger disappear into your nostril or your ear.
And don't get excited until you see something coming out this year.
So you've gone 70 years without that pinky on your left hand.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
And I used to deliberately say in class that what I was getting in pension for that, and I said, "I'll give you this for the same price." But no one ever took it up. It sounds serious, and I guess it is serious, but you don't have to be morbid about it. It's there, and it's happened, and I'm still here to tell you that it happened.
And you wanted to get back with your fellow Marines.
They told us that this would be the last time you can go back and join your division. I think I was the last guy off the ship. They took me back to where L Company was. Prusik, the officer, came down and he said, "Got a choice. You can either stay here in the rear echelon or you can go with us on this one and that'll be it." I said, "Fine, I'd rather go." You were glad to be back with the boys. You were glad to be there and you were glad you were still alive. And of course, I felt sorry about D.B. Kellenberger, who died because of me and because of a shy guy who shot them.
Yeah, he was one of more than 200 Americans killed in the capture of Roy Namur. Mr. O'Brien was among the more than 600 more who were wounded. There were 3,500 Japanese soldiers defending Roy Namur, After the four-day battle, only 51 of them survived. When we come back, a patched-up Marine, short one finger, heads to Saipan. And before we're done, the youngest of his 14 children will share a few words. For a video of Mr. O'Brien discussing his World War II injuries, check out the Hometown Heroes Facebook page. And keep it right here, because Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.